Haunted Wind Chimes. The song is called A Ballad of Modern Progress.
A river in old wooden fence surrounds all the sinners who stand by the graves, wondering what they've done wrong. There's a train whistleblower across the fiery desert in search for the new land. The treacherous weather is headed for the mountain to preach a brand new way. Ravaging the villages, they burn all the dead. Their world is full of privilege, and you're not one of them. You're just the number. So they came up with races, borders and fences, and job occupations, classifications, and aim to conquer, divide. Father, one mother, we must unite before they take our.
Thank you so much, guys.
November 1st, Anarchy Radio. That was indeed A Ballad of Modern Progress by Haunted Wind Chimes. Pretty strong stuff, and I thought it's noteworthy, and thank you, Carol, for turning me on to that. That was played this weekend on A Prairie Home Companion on NPR. I don't always listen to that
show. Bastion of Anarchy these days.
Exactly. Yeah, 30 years worth of cornball nostalgia, and then they put on this heavyweight thing here. This is a band from Colorado. Yeah, a pleasant surprise. Maybe that's just one more sign. As Carol pondered some things are starting to creep into the mainstream. Well, we're going to have a whole lot of different things tonight, and probably a phone call from Ian about the Steven Pinker book. I just very briefly referred to that a while ago, maybe a month ago. His thesis that there's actually less violence with civilization. Quite hilarious, and yeah, we'll probably get something on that. Well, a little bit of news. And speaking, I think this connects a little bit, too, with at least a slightly changing atmosphere or paradigm or something. I'm talking about the Greek government's decision, kind of sudden decision to have a vote, have a referendum on their, what's usually called the austerity program. They continue to bust their hump there in Greek, trying to stave off the debt crisis. And anyway, they're going to have a vote. The socialist government has been doing all the dirty work for the world system, and I think they've gotten tired of it, so they're just backing off. Okay, we're not going to, given the unremitting resistance to this, of having the people on the bottom swallow everything and absorb the beating, And I think that's the thing. They've gotten fed up with being the hatchet man, given this unending resistance, the fighting in the streets just constantly. And I think perhaps also they're seeing the Occupy thing. I'm not totally sold on the Occupy phenomenon, but you know, they look around and you could just imagine them saying, "Hey, why are we handling all this? Why are we getting beaten up every day in the press? Everybody hates us because we're squeezing all these people. Well, screw it. So we'll just have a vote. You know, do what you want." And of course, that vote's going to fail. And already there are these dire predictions of world economic collapse and so forth. So we're going to see. I do think that's a real factor in there. U.S. is planning a buildup in Kuwait after the Iraq exit. This is cute. You know, Obama decides or announces that there will be the pretty much full-out retreat from Iraq. But where are they going? Well, it used to be the 19th province of Iraq. It's called Kuwait. And there they sit next to Iran. If that isn't more militarism, it's not exactly a pullout. Well, we've got, let's see, Syria goes on and on. That resistance is just incredible. The months of that, along with Bahrain, Yemen, the energy out there, it's just, it's unrelenting. Well, in the past couple of weeks, the Obama government has also, of course, vetoed the idea of Palestinian statehood. I'm against states, as you might know, but the backdrop of that is Israel is accelerating more settlement building. And one of the specific things here is the forcible displacement of tens of thousands of Bedouins in the occupied West Bank. This is, they are at least nominally Palestinian. So, yeah, that's another ugly part of it. I mean, Bedouins, they are nomadic. They certainly practice animal domestication, but it's just another. And meanwhile, another wonderfully savory thing on the part of the U.S. government. For the 20th time, the U.N. General Assembly voted to condemn U.S. sanctions against Cuba, 186 in favor of ending the sanctions, with the U.S. and Israel in favor of keeping them. Mr. Hope and Change. Let's see what else. I'm trying to keep this short. Well, the threat of an underwater Bangkok, it's one of the major cities of the world, capital of Thailand, that's probably been avoided, but all of the industrial suburbs are underwater, close to 400 dead, the worst in Thai history in at least a half a century. It's caused the computer hard disk market to bulge. The prices are going way up in car parts. It's heavily industrialized there. And one of the things here is the number of crocodiles as the water has risen. I didn't know this, but there's all kinds of crocodile farming. We know about the salmon, the fish farming stuff, but the whole thing made more, well, against the backdrop of global warming, of course, this is this kind of weather, and 65 million Thailand residents now live in cities, and that whole process keeps going on. Well, let's see. Yes, famed crocodiles, farmed crocodiles escape their pens to roam the murky waters. All part of the gifts of development. Another big weather thing, might mention the astonishing snowstorm a few days ago. There's still 1.7 million people in the northeast part of the U.S. without power. An astonishing weather development for this time of year shattered every kind of record for snowfall. The blackouts, 32 inches of snow. That's more and more a staple as well. And the American distrust of government is at its highest ever. Seems like every week there's another study that says it's even higher than it was maybe a month ago. 89% of Americans say they distrust government to do the right thing. Yes, we have a caller?
Yeah, we have Ian.
Oh, good. Ian, thanks for calling.
No problem.
Good, good. So we can pick up the... we can pick up the Steven Pinker thing. Please let us hear from you about that.
Yeah, so I haven't, you know, this is, I guess, like an 800-page book. I haven't read it, but I've sort of gleaned enough from some of the reviews I've read recently. So the argument is, the initial claim of the book is that this is the least violent period of time in human history that we live in right now. And, you know, if you can accept that, you know, may or may not be plausible, I suppose, but it's sort of, as far as I can tell, it sort of hinges on what goes on the scale, you know, what's getting measured, you know, so things like how many people die of violent death or the murder rates in particular societies, I guess those are the kinds of things that he's measuring.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as I can tell, things that aren't going on the scale that might be relevant, you know, if he's concerned about whether violence is declining, it's not necessarily the same question as to whether suffering is declining or not. And that may be a more interesting question. You know, so things like industrially caused cancer, starvation, you know, things like those presumably aren't going on the scale, but, you know.
And every kind of emotional disease, which evidently was not around heretofore. So, I mean, how do you count the anxiety levels and all the people needing antidepressants, etc. That's violence, I think you could say.
Yeah, when you take those things into account, it's sort of, they're harder to quantify, I guess, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when you take those things into account, it's difficult to say whether, you know, maybe a violent death would be a worthwhile price to pay, or at least the increased odds of a violent death might be a reasonable price to pay.
Mm-hmm.
For a more fulfilling, kind of rich life.
That's an interesting assertion, yeah. And every death is violent, pretty much. So, how do you figure out the authenticity of life and how it's lived? You know, that's an important thing to ponder, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting to say, you know, how every death is violent. But I guess when it's, you know, things like cancer, it's you don't even have the satisfaction of knowing kind of where it's come from or what the trace is. You know,
mm-hmm.
People kind of are less apt to point fingers when something like that is the case, even though it is more often than not the decision, you know, the result of people's deliberate decisions.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the whole context too, that's probably, or perhaps anyway, a source of suffering itself. It's so generalized. You don't even know what's killing you. You know, I think you implied that.
Yeah, I think that's another good point, probably. Yeah, but so he doesn't necessarily probably frame it this way, although he does call it this the civilizing process. But, I mean, he's not out to defend civilization in any sort of explicit way. But I would imagine his book, you know, the premise of his book would be, you know, something that people would point to. So I was kind of curious as how you'd react to that.
Well, there was a previous book, an earlier one, not a fairly recent. I don't know when this came out. Not so long ago, by Pinker, called "The Blank Slate: The Modern Denial of Human Nature," and I think this the one we're talking about here, "The Better Angels of Our Nature: Why Violence Has Declined." They're tied together. I mean, the one follows the other, and I got. There was an article actually in Psychology Today debunking Pinker here, and he's talking about the origins of war in a big way in the Blank Slate book. And I, by the way, I thought that was a good sign in itself that a mainstream book like Psychology Today would go out of its way to thoroughly expose what's wrong with this book, the Blank Slate book. And it's based on, I just wanted to mention this a little bit, it's based on very much a book that I've attacked before. Lawrence Keeley's War Before Civilization, The Myth of the Peaceful Savage. And that the thesis there is that people were always bloodthirsty and killing each other. And it's crazy to think that before civilization or domestication, people were somehow living in harmony. And this article, it brings back my reading of it. And I think this article was by Christopher Ryan. I think it came out this spring. Well, basically, Pinker, his whole thing comes from Keeley. Keeley's take on 700-gatherer cultures, which he says are representative of prehistoric war-related death, male death in particular. And I'm not going to go through the list, but as Ryan points out, of these seven, only one is even vaguely hunter-gatherer. I mean, it's complete crap. It's completely... He's just mix-mastering the whole thing to anything that's primitive is hunter-gatherer. And as Ryan points out, they are thoroughly domesticated, these peoples. They were. They were not hunter-gatherers. And so whether or not they were bloodthirsty or not, you can't lie about the facts to back up a thesis. In other words, if you have to lie about it, you don't have much of a thesis. If this is the best you can do, then they include the Hivaro, Yanomami, several from the Amazon region, the Murngan from northern coastal Australia, which is almost the only Aboriginal group that's violent, and they're not hunter-gatherer. Papua New Guinea from the conflict-ridden, densely populated highlands of Papua New Guinea. Anyway, I'm spare you the details, but that it's quite amazing.
Yeah, that background is kind of interesting because, you know, most of what I've kind of come across, learned about the Pinker book is through this review in the New York Times by Peter Singer. And he mentions in there that that within Pinker's book, he does say that even hunter-gatherer societies, even so-called peaceful hunter-gatherer societies, were much, much more violent than any major city in the United States today, basically. So, but that's kind of looking at the murder rate for a particular city and pushing aside everything else that you might want to put on the scales.
Right, and these are after contact, by the way, too, where their lifeways have already, you know, been seriously eroded. And again, if you're looking at people that aren't hunter-gatherer in the first place, and also Pinker leaves out, in terms of his violence survey, leaves out all kinds of genocide. He never mentions the Rwanda or the different governments. The wars and dictatorships and wherever you want to, South America, Latin America, there's no mention. He doesn't mention any of the major wars or Pol Pot, the Khmer Rouge, stuff like that. He's somehow, that doesn't exist. That violence doesn't register. It's sad stuff. I mean, if you're an ideologue, you're in favor of civilization, okay. But again, let's be a little honest with the data.
Yeah, you know, the other initial reaction I had when looking at this, you know, sort of claim was curiosity as to whether if violence does go down or if it's just being displaced towards sort of non-human animals. You can imagine, you know, how many pigs die violent deaths right now. Well, probably close to 100% of them, you know.
Very important.
Quite different. But I'm sure that's not sort of going on the scale. So it's a lot of, you know, kind of, depends on what's being measured and what's being left out.
Sure. The accelerating extinction of species, never mind the slaughter of, you know, the factory animals of all kinds. That live horrible, stunted lives.
But from all accounts that I can see, the book seems to be getting rave reviews, which I suppose isn't too surprising if you say everything is great and we live in a wonderful world.
Mm-hmm.
You might like that, but is that sort of consistent with what you've seen?
Oh, well, the usual suspects.
Generally positive reaction to it.
Well, with some very good exceptions that we've mentioned a little bit. you can float that by to somebody who doesn't know any anthropology, I guess, you know, and then hope that nobody will call you on it. It's pretty disgraceful. It fits right in with the progressives, you know. Chomsky, he was a student, I think, in the neuroscience spinoff that Chomsky more or less founded. It's part and parcel of that gospel.
Yeah,
you know, you got to have more progress.
Things get better and better all the time.
And here's the attempt at an ideological underpinning for that at a time when more and more people are beginning to wonder, it's not turning out too well. This whole story is really pretty grisly. You know, it needs some help. You know, it needs somebody to prop it up.
Yeah, so
it's in the air.
Well, I happened to catch that a few days ago. I was kind of curious to your thoughts. So it's interesting. I think it sounds like, you know, more or less on the same page. And some of the background you provide is pretty interesting. So.
Yeah, yours as well. Thank you for calling, Ian.
Thanks a lot. I'll talk to you later.
Yeah, bye. Take care. Well, it's 541-346-6450645, as it always is. Well, I don't know if we can squeeze a whole lot of this in. I don't know how much I want to squeeze in, actually, but the Occupy phenomenon, whoa, we got to talk about that a little bit. Nashville, Denver, Atlanta, and of course, Oakland. And last Tuesday night, the big 4-hour set to downtown Oakland. And the developments subsequently, including, I'm going to kind of mostly look at it kind of negatively or skeptically, but something is going on. And I think the general deal, I'm guessing here, but it does show up even in places like Greece where they see which way the winds are blowing and they're tired of being the, doing the dirty work, as I say. Well, there was after the events in Oakland in the middle of last week, they called a general strike, and it's on for tomorrow. And it seems to me, and I'm hoping if somebody wants to call in, I'm sure they have. I've gotten some messages, but I'm not there. I haven't been there, so I could be missing a bunch. Could be getting it a little bit wrong. So you can please feel free to correct it. But anyway, it seemed like in the energy, the mood right after that, right after Tuesday night, and these things have been going back and forth in a number of places, maybe a little less spectacularly, either moving around or being evicted and then coming back, that sort of thing, and showing up in so many places. What I was hearing about, I think it was Wednesday, they were talking about, in fact, this was from somebody who's been around the block, a politico who's going to be down there, you know, going to be down there and trying to be a revolutionary presence, something like that. I thought it was funny because there was a reference to, this is kind of a staple of the ultra-left for good reason, for very good reason, I'm not putting this down, no parties, no unions. Looking back, we're not going to support either one of those types of institutions. Looking back, for example, in France in 68, where the movement was most importantly screwed by the parties and the unions more even than the parties, they had a more effective role in that. So this person who is writing this report, this long email for some people he knows, he mentioned in passing how that was dropped immediately, but they didn't want to be guilty of ideological purism or purity, so they just dropped that principle in a heartbeat. And they had this fantasy, I would call it a fantasy, strikes me as akin to back in the spring in Wisconsin, general strike, and so... You know, it gets back to that thing about the unions. Let's see now. Well, not only are the unions almost non-existent these days, but you have no power over them. That's the way it's designed. That's the way it's structured. That's the way it's enforced by federal labor law. You ain't going to have no control over the unions. And people like this individual know their role in society as a kind of police agent. especially at important times when things tend to boil over. That's, they're the safety net for the system. So anyway, they, it seems to me they kind of forgot their giddiness, and it got a little bit more sober. And I'm hoping it's not sober. Believe me, I'm. Don't get me wrong. I'm hoping wild things will happen, despite the stuff in its way. And we know something about what some of them are. And then it became, SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, is encouraging members to seek time off work. That's for the big strike tomorrow. Encouraging, can they get permission? You know, I mean, what happened to the full-on general strike? Also, the mayor on Friday, the mayor of Oakland said, people are free to take the day off. So, another radical move. So anyway, I don't know. And there are a number of conflicting things. One of the things, you know, this is just a well-known problem or issue, and that is the people that are the card-carrying pacifists, that any form of violence is forbidden. So there's an interplay between people like that, who evidently are more respectful of property and rules than they are of life. For example, I'm getting back to Oakland, and I think this was Tuesday night. Yeah, this is Tuesday night downtown there, 14th and Broadway. There were some black kids who were having a chance to go at the cops, so they were throwing some bottles, and the white liberal peaceniks really got offended and said that had, violent people are not part of this movement. You know, Oakland is black, you know, for starters, here, okay? And who is this guy, and who knows where he's from, is telling these people they have no right to be doing anything? These people who are at the wrong end of the stick when it comes to the pigs in Oakland forever. And it's a similar thing apparently happened Saturday night in Seattle, where some Nazis came in the middle of the night, 2:30 in the morning. I think there were, three of them? Full-out Nazis, even had Nazi insignia tattoos. They weren't, it wasn't Halloween. These were real white supremacist scum. And some people were trying to force them out of the space. And they were faced by these pacifists down there, or rather up there in Seattle, who attacked them. Attacked not the Nazis, but the people trying to get the Nazis out of the space. Yeah, that's really incredible. But it's par for the course. These people don't see this fantastic hypocrisy involved here. So that's always, these people are the cops. They are the ones enforcing. I mean, they can't even do something about Nazis who invade the place at 2:30 in the morning. They began to Sieg Heil and everything. I mean, there was no, they were just there in their face, and these sanctimonious pacifists were physically attacking the people that tried to force them out. Yeah. Well, just one more thing in a more general sense about all this. I happened to run across a book by Noam Chomsky from the 80s called Necessary Illusions, Thought Control in Democratic Societies. I don't remember having run across it. It's about Israel, it's about Latin America, and how the U.S. gets away with the strong-arm stuff around the world. That's kind of the general thing. And I thought, what is the more basic necessary illusion is with regard to the Occupy thing? In other words, what is the deeper thought control going on here about mass society? And today, I think this is today or maybe it was yesterday, posted at anarchistnews.org, inviting the anarchists out. In other words, why don't you go somewhere and do something else? The anarchists who don't believe in a mass movement should avoid taking part in the Occupy mass movement, because you will be disappointed. If you don't believe in participatory democracy, then why don't you leave us alone, kind of thing, you know, along with the along with the, but the contradiction there, and I wonder if this has come up at all, really. I mean, it's more the distinction to me that is about mass society, a mass movement insofar as it reproduces a mass society. That's the connection. But if you believe in mass society, then there's no place for you. Is that another way to put it? In other words, participatory democracy. And I think that process is, you know, that's pretty much ideal. Horizontal, consensus-based, all that kind of stuff. But if you're at the same time not questioning mass society, you can call it participatory democracy, but then again you have that question of how would that work? Complex society cannot be run by horizontal consensus meetings. Isn't that kind of starkly clear? You know, it's just that isn't possible. It isn't conceivable. So if your slogan is global democracy now, you can forget about the horizontal consensus stuff, and the people that are questioning globalized industrial society, mass society, you know, I don't think, I would not like to say there's no room for them, because that's the crucial thing, it strikes me. That's the qualitative change or the radical break, the thing that starts with that kind of questioning. And it's just a contradiction that's kind of obvious. And I don't know, maybe it's already being discussed, but that's the stakes in a very important sense, I would say. Well, we're going to take a music break and come out and get into a bunch of other stuff, and I hope you'll call 541-346-0645. Hello there. Okay, we got a couple of ads. I think the ads went over kind of well last week. Kind of strange ones. Here's one from Mizuho Corporate Bank of Japan. I always enjoy alliteracy. This makes this kind of doubly funny to my sense of humor anyway. Mizuho toward a better world, our, quote, unchanging values, unquote, can make it a reality. Nobody told them that putting it in quotes means it isn't literally true. You know, like if you put a nickname in quotes, it means that isn't the real name. It's a nickname. So if you put unchanging values in quotes, obviously it means it's it's not unchanging values. As a global financial institution, we are committing to pursuing our, quote, unchanging values. That's pretty good. And they have a picture of a screen held up in front of a sort of a deserty looking vista. Yeah, but in the picture in the screen, it's green and it's got wind turbines and it's a nice green city in the background. So because Mizuho Corporate Bank played a major role in eco-friendly town projects in China and India. All right. Is it going well in India and China? Okay, Xylem, that's spelled X-Y-L-E-M. Let's solve water. I don't know if I've ever heard of Xylem. From ITT. Ooh, it's a spinoff of ITT. Okay. From ITT comes Xylem. Learn more about the possibilities at xyleminc.com. So, let's solve water. It's a big old full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal today. Let's solve water. Let's push it up 80-floor buildings and up and away from 3,000-foot mine shafts. I kid you not. Let's solve water. Let's push it up 80-floor buildings and up and away from 3,000-foot mine shafts. Okay. That's solving the water problem. Projects like that. Here's a two-page ad in the current issue of Wired magazine from Dow. Yeah, not only are napalm folks but at Dow, but of course they've moved on. And it shows people in the most famous plaza in Milano with the Duomo there and the Galleria off to the side. Probably the most well-known site in Milan. And everybody there has an Einstein haircut. And there's even a guy on a bicycle, kind of wheeling around on his bicycle, wearing a tie, but it sort of looks like Albert Einstein. Dow solutions are used in the production of 95% of the world's smart devices. From more vivid colors to more speed to more capabilities in less space, that's how smart becomes brilliant. Together, the elements of science and the human element can solve anything. That's solutionism, the new optimism. Yeah. I wonder how many people are that optimistic about the techno future. They're kind of clutching at straws. Or, what's the phrase? Whistling past the graveyard? Something like that. Kind of a big old stretch. Everybody with their Einstein haircuts. Onward. Let's see. Action news. We got some tasty action news from different places, that's for sure. Wednesday, in the capital of Yemen, Sana'a, women burned veils during a rally in protest of a government crackdown on demonstrators. Quite an amazing photo in the New York Times. Also Wednesday, this was a major arson. A Walmart set on fire in Veracruz, Mexico. Oh, man, this is a major thing. I saw the photo and flames were leaping out of the roof of this thing. It's from the Conspiracy of Cells of Fire / Informal Anarchist Federation. Liberatory fire again burn where it hurts most, destroying merchandise. Liberatory fire at the Walmart in Veracruz, the heart of Veracruz, in solidarity with anarchist prisoners and part of their new offensive. We don't want to change capital in the state. We don't want to change their laws. We don't want improvements. We don't want to change technology. We don't want to change domination. We want to destroy them. Oh, yeah. All right, let's see. And I think this was Wednesday. Yeah. Another riot. major riot in China, the government had levied a tax which would have affected mostly migrant workers just west of Shanghai in these small workshops. They were going to slap a tax on them, and 28 people were detained after more than 30 cars were damaged and or burned. And the government withdrew that tax. Another victory. Yeah, outrage over taxes rocks a Chinese town. Big coverage in some of the leading papers. And late last week, another outbreak of riots. A drunken cop drove his cruiser into a crowd, killed 5 people. And the story, the backdrop, it says in the story, protests are on the rise in China. He was drunk, and after the tax thing, which went on for 2 days, this was quite a battle as well. And on Thursday, waving bows and arrows and dressed in war paint, hundreds of members of indigenous communities in the Brazilian Amazon invaded the construction site of the Belo Monte hydroelectric dam to permanently occupy the site in their latest attempt to stop the dam. And that, as I mentioned last week, they are not giving up on that one. And somewhat relatedly, in Mexico, some 200 Wixarotari and Huichol men, women, and children from western Mexico came to the capital to defend their sacred ceremonial sites from mining, silver mining. Demonstrators from their mountain villages in the states of Jalisco, Nayarit, and Durango, they held protests Thursday and Friday to stop the activities of foreign mining companies in the high desert of the central state of San Luis Potosi. And on Thursday in Los Angeles, ALF decided to visit Michael Bollinger, Vice President of Business Development and Consulting for Aptium Oncology. Showed up at his house and with a good deal of red spray paint, paint stripper, etching paste. Aptium is part of AstraZeneca subsidiary, which supports Huntington Life Sciences. Not too much in favor of animal torture. And a Bolivian bank, La Paz, that is, this was posted on Friday. I'm not too sure just when that is, but a bank in Bolivia. Well, no, sorry. This was ATM machines steps away, 10 meters away from the Central Bank of Bolivia and in front of the offices of the mayor of La Paz, was torched up with an incendiary mixture. And, you know, what's not going away seems to be becoming more radical is the anti-corruption movement in China. There was a big story in the Sunday New York Times, the October 30th New York Times. You know, cleaning up the system, that's whatever it is, it's not radical. But this movement is not only about corruption. This movement has acquired a deeper dimension of seeking to change the whole system. They quote various people to that effect. Nebraska, you know, this whole horrible Keystone XL pipeline that would go all the way from Alberta, northern Alberta, to refineries in the Gulf of Mexico. The public outcry has just continued to get louder and louder, stronger and stronger, said a state senator in Nebraska. They had to have a special session on the issue. There's a lot of growing opposition. They don't want that pipeline going through Nebraska. Nebraska, that hotbed of whatever it is. And in Seattle, a couple of other things. The Seattle Free Riders Union is urging people to show a NOPE card, which looks surprisingly similar to the ORCA card. That's the prepaid bus card that you flash to get on the light rail or the bus. And they're not... I remember when I lived in San Francisco, there were people who would counterfeit the bus, the monthly bus pass, and they were always having to the city was always having to change the colors and put in different combinations of colors to make the color copier, to challenge it more so that it wouldn't come out right. But this is bolder. This is just says nope. You know, you flash the card, ain't gonna pay. And so, well, in San Francisco, I remember there were quite a few bus drivers. They'd look at the thing and they knew it was a fake, then they'd just smile and like whatever. You know, they wouldn't make you get off the bus. That varied, of course. Okay. Well, one other thing, and I'm pleased to relate this. This is the brand new Orion magazine, November, December issue, and the new column, Upping the Stakes, the regular column by Derek Jensen. It's called Bright Green Reality Check, and it's trashing various types of sort of greenwashing, environmentalism. And anyway, he has gotten back at least a little bit, just to quickly in passing, that indeed civilization is at the base of this. So I salute you, Derek Jensen. I'm glad you haven't completely forgotten that. I stand corrected. Let's see some more of that. This is a good, strong column. There's nothing sustainable about any of this. This is just reality, and he's just trashing people who, like he mentions, for example, aluminum recycling, and all of the costs in recycling. You can just easily count them up yourself. You gotta have trucks picking up. It's not when you start kind of deconstructing it. And as he mentions, once the aluminum gets to the recycling factory, it must be heated to 650 degrees Celsius. Now, how do you do that sustainably? And what do you do with the toxic chemicals needed in the recycling process? And what do you do with, I mean, he just runs down the list of the illusion of some of these things that these bright green environmentalists are trying to peddle that are completely bogus. And it gets right down to the heart of the system. I just one very slight thing. At the end, he says what he calls deep green environmentalism, and you know we know something about the organizational side of that. He says it follows the philosophical tradition of deep ecology, and that's a little bit questionable. Deep ecology doesn't have much interest in institutions, and that can be a big weak spot, blind spot. They're pretty much ahistorical. They have these principles that they uphold, but they don't really want to get into what makes it impossible to apply or honor these, you know, basic principles of deep ecology. But it's a good column. It's a quite good column. I'm happy that he's back to some degree back to critique of civilization. Well, gee, we've only got 10 minutes left. 541-346-0645. This is kind of a little bit of anthropology corner. Two things here. This is earlier in October, middle of October. From a South African cave, possibly you've seen this finding by archaeologists, a 100,000-year-old workshop, and basically there's evidence of mixing of paint, the first known paint. There aren't paintings there, but this is in the journal Science in the middle of October, and this is the earliest example by far of symbolic activity. If this holds up, it's interesting though, if this was an art studio, so to speak, there wasn't any symbolic activity or symbolic culture for quite a while after that, but this seems to be the sign of, some of these things have come undone, like the use of ochre on corpses ochre is used for all kinds of things. It doesn't necessarily prove. It was used as a preservative and a whole lot of things, and it's been used to argue a symbolic aspect, a symbolic consciousness of human existence in terms of funeral rites, if you want to call it that. But some of that is a little difficult to prove. But this is just a few days ago. What are called sophisticated tools, these are blades, these are stone tools, advanced blade production. They found some of this 30, 40,000 years ago, along with the cave art, by the way. But this, evidently, they have found in a cave near Tel Aviv, stone blades dated between 200,000 and 400,000 years ago. And these findings are now being published. I mean, this is Lower Paleolithic, of course, and standardized kind of workshop turning out what they're calling sophisticated tools with different features. Not exactly the Swiss Army knife, but using predetermined blanks and. I'm not going to get into lithic details here, but quite amazing. These things are always being pushed back, whatever they are. They're always further back. And it keeps raising the question, what is a modern human? What is Homo sapiens? When we see all these capacities way back, and further back than this, by the way, the control of things like that. And yet, there was no domestication or civilization for hundreds of thousands of years, subsequently. Okay, how about some tech news here? This is from the latest Wired. There's an article about how the kids are very tech savvy. They sure know how to Google everything. But increasingly, if there's a real steady kind of a total diet of Googling, how do they know when the results are crap? The Google stuff, I mean, they don't know if it's true or not. They don't have any idea, ultimately, you know, insofar as that's all they're doing is learning how to Google. That's kind of obvious. The Smart Planet thing, this is IBM, from IBM. Microsoft and Carnegie Mellon are unveiling OmniTouch, a system that turns any surface into a touchscreen. It's a little projector and camera thing. You know, your hand turns into a keyboard. Yeah, so the machine and the body kind of merge there. There's a 3D device. This is a brand new thing from Sony, the visor-like headset. It's even more along the lines of people staring at their phones and their text screen as they bump into you on the sidewalk. This is really the full deal. You can't see anything. The screen is just an inch from your eyes. It's a 3D video thing. It's 3D high definition and in your face. Yeah, you wear the thing around your head. And an article about it, quoting Sherry Turkle, who wrote Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. Gadgets like 3D headsets are seductive, she said, but the danger is that they seal people off from their environment and from others. People used to walk with eyes to the sand and water, using the example of people strolling at the seashore. Now everyone walks with a device. No one is looking at the sand. Immersive devices, you know, of all sorts. The technology, which looked so good to some 15 to 20 years ago, now looks like it helps us miss out on the complexities and grittiness and ups and downs of what real life has to offer. Sadly, Turkle, as I've mentioned before, has no intention of seeing an end to the, which he sees as the presumably natural, inevitable rolling out of all this. That's the major contradiction there. And Ad Age, this is there, they do ads. Ad Age did a study about how people's lives have changed and what has been the biggest change in the past 10 years. And this is middle class folks here. The biggest thing was, the top answer was being infused with technology And then right after that, the biggest change, and figure out the connection, lives are more complicated, more stressful. Adage concluded, as people of means acquire more technological devices to simplify their lives have actually become more complicated. Technology doesn't mean less work or stress. You might have noticed. But, of course, as with Steven Pinker, for instance, there are certainly voices, plenty of voices, saying how it's going to save us. There's a last Tuesday, Thomas Friedman, the well-known New York Times columnist, his column then was called "There Is Hope in the Latest Technology Revolution, Hyper-Connected, Super-Empowered." It's going to change everything. We're going to have the cloud given to us by these enormous server farms. Speed, everything now is happening faster. You kind of wonder, what is the good part? What is he talking about? What is great about this? It's happening here in America. And the last line, like I said, the news isn't all bad. But he's contrasting it with the economic news to somehow make a point. But I think I was quoting Margaret Atwood last week. Here's another very similar thing, and this was in Wired, about how movies and television now, the emphasis is backward, the traveling back in time. You don't find offerings that are about the future, because the future is just too horrifying. The future holds no promise for current problems, so why fast forward? Says Mary Choi. Yeah, it's kind of obvious, but, you know, it's worth pointing out. It's worth drawing attention to, I think. Okay, well, maybe you've got time for one more from England, kind of like the U.S., kind of like maybe a number of places, from the Independent newspaper last Wednesday. Highly caffeinated energy drinks have become an integral part of a frenzied workaholic culture in the UK, and nearly three-quarters of young people say they drink them regularly. Yes, and I guess we're out of time. Thank you, Chase. Walkie-talkies and the Secret Service.